Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a safe place for leading with your heart. Hey, thanks for being here. You, Me, Empathy is the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective, a collaborative mental health community designed to empower each of us to grow our capacity for empathy, vulnerability, and emotional wayfinding. Just a friendly reminder that this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. No one is just a silly boy with a feely heart. You can support the show by leaving a review in Apple Podcasts, following us on social media at Yumi Empathy and Feely Human, and joining the Feely Human Collective community at feelyhuman.co. And now your host, Noan Wells.
Hello, Feely Humans. Welcome to another episode of your favorite mental health podcast. It's You, Me, Empathy. And my name is Noan Wells. I am your creator and host. This is episode 169 on shifts, othering, and literacy and mental health with therapist and wellness coach Mina B. Mina is a delight. I previously connected with her on the NAMI Orange County podcast, It's Okay to Feel. And in this episode, we talk about life's inevitable and uncomfortable shifts, the othering we do as humans, and how we can push against it as individuals and communities. Mina's early childhood experience of being bullied and the isolation and heartache that came with it, and the magical confluence of literacy, storytelling, and mental health, among many others. We get into a lot in this episode, and I really loved this conversation. The trigger warning for this show is that suicidal ideation and self-harm are mentioned, and bullying, as I mentioned as well. So just so you know, we don't get into, you know, details, but those things are mentioned. So that's the trigger warning for this show. Before we get to the episode, though, a couple of things I wanted to share. One very new thing and very exciting thing is over at feelyhuman.co, feelyhuman.co. I have a new workshop. It's called Illustrating Empathy. And if you're an artist or if you're not an artist, it's for you. You don't have to be an artist. Essentially, it's a little empathy and art workshop. Something I've held before for, you know, private communities, but I'm opening it up to you, the public, Feely Human space, and it's only $5, and the workshop will be about a month from today on April 14th at 2 p.m. Pacific time. The workshop is designed to help each of us think about empathy a little differently for ourselves, for others, and there's some art homework at the end, which is exciting, and it'll be fun. I'm limiting the workshop to about 30 people. It's only $5 to join. If you want to learn more about that, go to illustratingempathy.com. That's illustratingempathy.com. And hope to see you there. The other things I wanted to mention is that you can subscribe to the Feely Human newsletter. So I'm sending that out in a couple of days. So if you want to, I send out one every month. I do some writing. It's kind of like where I'm only doing my writing nowadays in the Feely Human newsletter. So if you want to see my writing and see what's going on in the Feelyverse, the link to the newsletter is in the show notes for this episode. Or you can go to feelyhuman.co and scroll down to the bottom to subscribe. The other thing, if you want to support me and the work I do, a free way to do that is to leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It truly does help out the show. The more ratings I get, the higher it ranks in the charts, more people see it, and more people are getting empathy and feelings into their world, which, as you know, is what we need. So please do that if you haven't left a review. Another way to support me is at Patreon, patreon.com/feelyhuman. For $5 a month, you get a bonus episode of this podcast. For $10 and up, we have monthly Zooms. And this month's monthly Zoom, we're going to be talking about boundaries, which is, I think we're going to be doing that next week. So if you want to get on in on that, go to patreon.com/feelyhuman. And yeah, if you have a little money, great. If not, no worries. I love you anyways. The other thing I wanted to mention is, like, just a couple of days ago, a delightful thing happened. I had Emily McDowell on episode 165 of this podcast. Emily McDowell is, of course, the founder of M and Friends. It used to be called Emily McDowell Studios. And I loved that conversation. And she shared the episode on her her personal Instagram feed, M on Life, or Emily on Life, I believe. And a bunch of new followers came in, and hopefully a bunch of new listeners. Hello. Happy you're here. And I just wanted to thank Emily for that. It's just such a nice thing to do. You know, you never know what guests share and who, you know, and where, and that's okay. And I don't want to ever pressure anyone for sharing. I know it's vulnerable to be on this show. It takes courage, and sometimes it's, you know, after we do it, like, maybe we don't want to share it, and that's okay too. You know, I think I'm open to all of it. And so when I saw Emily share it, it was a delight, and I was so thankful for that. So Emily, if you're listening, thank you, friend. When this pandemic is over, when you got our vaccinations, I would love to come up to Portland and give you a big bear hug. Okay, so let's do that. Let's make a date for that. Anyways, let's get into the episode, okay? Thank you for being here, everyone. I truly appreciate you. I'm so grateful you're taking the time to honor yourself by being in the space of feelings and mental health and, you know, empathy. So thank you. Let's get into this episode with Mina B on shifts, othering, and literacy and mental health. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective. On this show, we explore the struggles, the triumphs, the brights and the darks we face as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our mental health, our neuroses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, I am choosing replenishing, enriching self-care because I'm here with therapist, mental health educator, podcaster, and fellow literary nerd, Mina B. Hello, Mina.
Hi, Noam. Thank you for having me for that wonderful introduction.
Yes, I'm so happy to have you. I, you know, the listeners should know we connected previously on the first season of the NAMI OC podcast, It's Okay to Feel. And yes, it's great to be with you again.
Yeah, same here. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So we always kick off the show, Mina, with an emotional check-in. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling content today.
Where is that coming from? What amounts to that contentment?
Well, I think it's just been a lot of shifts that I'm dealing with lately, but shifts in a very good way. So actually, one of my biggest shifts that I did recently was I quit my full-time job. And because of that, I feel today's day one of me stepping into my full-time entrepreneurial journey. It's something I've been balancing. Yeah, it's something I've been balancing for years now while working a job. And it's one of those things where often I've asked myself, when will I know it's the right time? And my body and my mental health started to signal to me that right now is the right time. And so, yeah, today is actually day one of me not waking up to clock into work virtually because I was working from home due to the pandemic. But I would say that contentment comes from just feeling at peace with where I am, but also very happy that I don't necessarily have so much on my plate the way I'm used to.
Yeah. Wow. Congratulations. That's a big, bold move.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. So what is this entrepreneurial journey that's ahead of you? Do you know what that looks like yet?
Right now, I don't feel like I have a full glimpse, but I do have a small window, and that is me just coming together and providing my community with different offerings that I've been wanting to do and plan for some years now. And although I envisioned a lot of these offerings happening in person, I, of course, have to shift to this technology-based platform, and that's fine with me. I think after 2020, I'm just used to it at this point. But yeah. What I will say is I am going to be doing some online coaching, and I'm going to be offering virtual workshops. And so that is the first step of my journey. And I'll continue to do the things that I was already doing. And so I do a lot of, I write a lot of opinion pieces, and I also do a lot of speaking engagements. And so that is something I already have planned to continue to do. But something new that I'm stepping into is actually being able to provide my community with specific workshops and offerings that I'm able to now do with the free time that I have.
That's amazing. That makes me so happy. I love when, I mean, just the simple fact of like listening to your mental health, listening to your body, and that takes practice, right? Like taking practice to like what feels right, like what feels good. And the thing that we did for a time, like, you know, sometimes that changes, right? Like sometimes it just stops not feeling aligned with like where we're headed, and then we have to shift.
Exactly. And I think shifts are just were a big theme for me in 2020, because a lot of us, everyone had to shift. The sense of normalcy that we had to be shifted and transitioned in some sort of way. And so now dealing with that on a societal level, but then on an individual level, I think that this has been a great time for me to just lean into myself more and trust that process of knowing that there is a direction, there's a path in front of me. But in order for me to journey there, I have to lean into it, and I have to trust myself enough to be able to get there. And so that's where I am. And it's been great so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been trying to do more of that in my life. And I'm wondering if this is the case for you, Mina. There is some discomfort in that leaning, right? Like, because you're maybe it's honoring yourself more, maybe it's you know, it's a journey of more awareness of self, you know, and with that comes, you know, some discomfort. Have you had any of that discomfort and leaning into yourself more?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think it's just because life is really all about taking risks. And so when it's time to take that leap and when it's time to lean in, oftentimes we start thinking about the risks that we're taking by doing this thing. And sometimes we start to weigh the pros and cons, and oftentimes people might lean more toward what the cons are, and it holds them back from stepping into what is meant for them or what they want for themselves, despite having this whole list of pros. And so for me, you know, I will say I too recognize that I'm leaving my full-time job and there's risks involved, but what are those risks? I had to really identify what are those risks. And if the risk is like your business might not run the way you want it, or your business might fail, what are the resources that you'll have that you can bounce back? And for me, I'm like, well, you're qualified. You can go and get yourself another job. This is not the first time that you've worked. You have your credentials. You have what you need to get back in this field. And so why not trust this process? And also, if you need to create a plan B, because right now there is no plan B since I'm trusting fully in plan A, but I do know if I need to pull plan B out, plan B really would just be, hey, you're going to have to go back to work, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I just think a lot of it is, as I said, I did have experiences of discomfort during this time, but I had to weigh the pros and cons. And for me, the cons were really rooted in me recognizing that my mental health was plummeting. And so it's like, yes, there's a chance your business might fail, but also if you stay doing what you're doing, you're going to recognize that you're going to continue to feel miserable. You're going to continue to feel burnt out. You're going to continue to feel stressed. And so right now the pros are outweighing the cons. And there's also other alternatives if things don't go the way you want it. And so to be able to combat that negative voice or push against the discomfort, those are the things that I had to tell myself so that I can be in the place that I'm in now, where I'm just fully, like I said, leaning into the journey. And it's day one of being a full-time entrepreneur.
Yes, I love it. I love it so much. I find that like we humans tend to, and I wonder if you relate to this, we humans tend to, in our wanting to kind of like hold on to the things that bring us comfort, or the things that we're just used to that are part of our identities or whatever that we hold on to. When we get that way, we can get a little bit too insular and a little, you know, we put up, you know, maybe some walls, and we're not, maybe to your point, we're not looking at the big picture. We're not like taking in the whole context of the situation and having the perspective of, okay, if I make this decision, these are the potential risks. These, you know, you're just not seeing the big picture.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and this is why it's really important to also have community support, because during this time as well, I didn't do a lot of this on my own. Like, of course, I said, I'm going to have to be the one who makes the decision. And, you know, this is my life. So whatever happens, it's going to be impacting me and me only. But community support is really helpful during times like this, because sometimes you might struggle with looking objectively at your circumstances, and being able to talk to someone who you know sees the potential that you have, is invested in you and your journey, being able to provide you with guidance and wisdom. It's really important to have those types of friendships in your life, because sometimes you might need that outside person, the same way people go to therapy because they need someone to help them see their lives objectively. They struggle with doing that themselves, which is why they're going to a professional to say, hey, I'm struggling with my mental health. I'm struggling with these areas, and I really don't know what to do. I'm trying. And by talking to a therapist, you get insights that you may have never realized or thought before. And even if you don't have access to a therapist, again, this is why community is so important. So for me, although I made this decision, I wasn't alone in this process. I had so much encouragement. I had people who I shared my experiences with, and people who were pouring back into me and reminding me and helping me see from an objective place of, well, look at this that is happening in your life, and look at all these other things that are happening in your life that I actually forgot about, you know? Mm. And so being able to have that community support is also a vital part of how I am able to be where I am today. And it's just so important to just have the right people around you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I tell this anecdote on the show. I've told it a couple times, but I have a tendency, Mina, to kind of shut down emotionally when I'm feeling like I'm having a joyful experience, because like deep down I feel like, you know, stemming from childhood, that like joyful experiences weren't something I should have or should experience. Mm-hmm. And so this was like last year sometime, I was playing a board game with some friends and I was recognizing that I was having a joyful time, and my partner Jessica recognized in me before I did even that I was starting to shut down, because I was outwardly having joyful experiences, and you know, the weird sort of shutting down, you know, part of me was starting to take over. And she called me out on it, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is happening, you know. So to your point, we need each other.
Absolutely. You know, it's really important to, and then the right people, you know, like that's your partner. And so this is someone who knows you intricately and someone who I would assume wants the best for you and pours into you. And so having community is just so vital. Because like I said, and like you're even describing in your own experiences, sometimes we don't even realize what's taking place. You know, it's like other people are watching a movie that's our lives, and they're like, I noticed this and I observed that. And you're like, what, that happened? and so, you know, it's really just so important. And I really, really encourage people to do what they can to get the right community in their lives.
Yeah, indeed. So you mentioned that, you know, prior to this shift, this recent shift, your mental health was plummeting a bit. Do you want to share a little bit about what that looked like for you?
Yeah. I was just really stressed. I was burned out. I was stretching myself in so many different places that I was struggling to, speaking of the theme of joy, I felt like I didn't have any joy. Mm. I felt like when in my business, when I was accomplishing things, I couldn't even savor it, because I had so much stuff to do that it's like, all right, well, I crossed this off the calendar and I crossed this off my goal list, but my attention is needed somewhere else. So I don't even have a moment to pause, sit with it, savor it, and reflect on it. I got to keep going. And that's not the life that I want to live. That's not in alignment with my values of living intentionally. And so I started to just recognize that I felt flat. I felt emotionless. I started to feel very robotic. I started to feel like I was just a machine that was just producing and producing. And it got to the point where like, even the things that I enjoyed, I couldn't even get the opportunity to sit with myself. And so, I mean, this might sound funny to some people, but I really like watching Netflix. I like to have time within my day to have TV time. And once I started noticing that I couldn't even carve out space in my schedule to watch a 50-minute show, I was just like, I'm being stretched in way too many places. And I think too, with the pandemic, because I'm home and I don't have anywhere to go, it kind of felt like, well, you're home, so just keep, you know, being busy makes sense. You know, it's not like you have a brunch skate date scheduled or you're going to go see a movie. And so it was kind of like one of those things where it was like, well, you know, why not? Like, you're just going to be sitting here anyway. And then over time, I realized, oh, that actually isn't going to work. Like, that's something that I have to change. And so that's what it looked like for my mental health to plummet, where I just kind of felt dry and I felt a little empty. And I was like, okay, I can't keep complaining about this. I have to take charge of what's impacting me in my mental health. And that's why making the decision to leave my job was very vital for me.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I'm going to assume that many people can relate to that experience, because as you know, and I'm wondering like if you've unpacked like where that comes from, because there is, as you know, Mina, like this cultural, societal, you know, corporate business sort of thing going on here in the States where it's, you know, we value productivity. We value keeping busy as like this intrinsic value. And even if we're not like calling it out like vocally in our lives, it's like maybe in the back of our heads, and maybe we feel pressure because we're comparing ourselves to others who are doing more, quote unquote, more than us, you know? And so it's understandable, but I like it. Was that piece of it for you? Like the cultural piece and influence?
I'm sure in many ways it was, because I know that that is something that I've spent years trying to work on, being unlearning a lot of the patterns that I'm conditioned to believe. Mm. And I'm quite sure, I think when it comes to those things, it's really difficult, because at the end of the day, we are forced into a level of productivity by having to commit to jobs in the first place. And yeah. So I think the fact that we live in a society where labor is forced upon us, or else we won't be able to. I mean, even if you're working for yourself, that's still labor, right? Yeah. You have to produce. We don't live in a world where money literally falls from trees. And I wish we did. But right. I really wish we did. But at the end of the day, labor is a part of life. And that tone already makes it difficult, because there's parts of our days that we have to shift and give our time, attention, and energy to this thing. And I think too, for me, what started to happen was I think in many ways, I just kind of felt like this is what was not necessarily what was expected of me, but I do feel like I put some pressure on myself to just find things to do. And if it was like, well, just work, right? Like, you know, don't have idle time. Just do something with it. And I think it was more, why not do work? Because like I said before, idle time would mean let's go out, let's go have a drink, let's go see a movie, let's go for a walk. And with the pandemic, it just kind of felt like I'm bored. And if I'm bored, my mind just took me to a place of, well, if you're going to do something about being bored, just work, you know? So I do think 2020 did impact that as well, because a lot of what my behaviors were are different, you know, that shifted as well, where it's like, if you're home, and then also thinking about the winter months, where these last few months, I'm in New York City. So majority of the year is cold, you know, we got the summer came, and, you know, things are great for about 3 months, but then you go back into this season of coldness. And so you feel forced in the home as well. So that is, those are some things that I will definitely say came up for me. And I do think I know I'm still unpacking this idea of productivity and knowing that rest is important, which is why I was saying too, I value spending time watching Netflix. And once I realized that this level of productivity was getting in the way of me being able to just sit on my couch and watch a show, that bothers me, because there's no reason for me to feel like I need to generate and produce all day long. But because I had 40 hours of my week being consumed by this other thing, to keep up with my own business, I was using my supplemental time to generate and produce things that my business needed. And that's when I realized, like, there's no way I can keep up with doing both at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that disruption of normalcy you mentioned earlier. You were, for a time, like, knew what to do with the quote unquote idle time. And then, yeah, all of a sudden we're like, what does that look like now that we're home all day, every day, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely what it was. And so I was just like, well, you're home, just write and just do this. And then you realize, like, oh, maybe like there's other things that you might want to do besides working all the time.
How, like, is there, I mean, you talk about boundaries a lot, like, how does like social media play a role in this decision for you? Because, you know, you're someone who's, you know, very popular on Instagram, you know, people love your stuff, as do I. Like, how does that play a role in this decision?
I would say that, social media is something that for a long time I have taught myself to develop a boundary around. And that was just because I found at some point a while ago, I found myself just scrolling consistently. And I realized because I do use social media as a way to grow my brand, I need to have some sort of boundary around it because I don't want to be consumed by it. So I would say social media is actually the first thing that I had learned how to set a boundary around. And then it became this, like the work stuff I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And with social media, it really just looks like me carving out time in my day to create content so that I'm not waking up and like trying to figure out what I want to produce and then feeling a little stressed. So I have a system where I just create content in advance and a mass amount of content. And then on the day of, I have a specific time that I post already. So I generally I'll post between like 8:30 and 10 a.m. in the morning. And I like to post in the morning because it just gets it out the way and I have the rest of my day. And when it comes to like engaging, one, I only mainly use Instagram. So luckily, I'm not one of those people who is heavily engaged on like five different platforms because I think that would also stress me out.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. And I also think that outside of that, because I only pretty much utilize Instagram, I've been able to just set aside a time. Okay, this is when I'm going to post. This is when I'm going to be active in my stories. And that's pretty much it for me. Like I have boundaries where I have an app limit. And so once my app tells me you've hit an hour of being on Instagram today, that's it for me. And generally, most of the time, I never even get the alert because I don't even spend that much time on there. And I've trained myself to decrease the amount of time I'm spending on Instagram by just, again, finding other things that I need to do. And yeah, I just found that my energy is needed elsewhere. And what am I gaining? If I'm going to be scrolling endlessly on Instagram, maybe it needs to be networking. It needs to be something outside of just staring at a bunch of pictures and content all day. So yeah, I would say that Instagram actually was like the first area where I realized I needed to create some sort of boundary around work. And it's been helpful for me.
That's great. Yeah, no, that sounds very healthy. I love that. You know, Instagram can be a wonderfully connecting place, but you know, like anything, we need balance, we need flow, we need boundaries. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. Absolutely.
So I do want to dip back into like before you got into this work, but first, like, help me. This is a fun question. Like what kinds of TV shows are you enjoying on Netflix?
Well, right now I'm enjoying The Queen's Gambit. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but
I've not. Really, I've heard it's great.
It's so good. It's really, really good. It's a limited series, so I'm already preparing myself to have to find something else to watch because it's not going to, I know no more seasons will be coming out after this. So that's what I'm watching. I'm waiting for This Is Us to come back. They came back in the fall with only 3 episodes, which was a little disappointing, but they're supposed to be coming back in January. And another thing that I do to kill time when I'm like, I don't know what show to watch, but I want to just sit down and relax and watch something. I'm really big into baking. So I've spent a lot of time watching Sugar Rush, which is a baking show where they like do a challenge and like a bunch of bakers come together to win a prize. And they have to create like these interesting desserts with these interesting ingredients. And those are the types of things I enjoy watching. So yes. I think I spent pretty much majority of my time because I took holiday before the year started, because I said I definitely have to take a break. And they had Sugar Rush Christmas edition. And I probably watched like, I don't even know how many episodes of it, but it was just so good. So that's when I don't have a specific show, or like if I finish the season and I don't know what to watch, I'll switch gears and I'll watch something related to baking.
Yes. I also am fond of baking shows. There's something like we you know, powered through all of the Great British Bake Off stuff. It's so, I don't know. It's like, first of all, everyone is just so delightful and like positive and kind. And then, you know, it's kind of therapeutic watching them just work with flour and butter. And I don't know, there's something about it that's very calming.
Yeah. And then to know it's a challenge. I always say, like, I don't, like, you have to be so good at this where they can say, makers, you have to create this crazy item and they know what to do. Like, that to me is phenomenal because I'm like, I have, like, just give me a basic recipe and I can do it. But, like, to get a, go somewhere and you, I don't know, maybe if they know in advance, I don't know how that stuff works. But I'm like, the fact that off the top of their heads, they know how to create things is just amazing to me. So I'm always interested in seeing the final product. So that is what gets hooked me, gets me hooked in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed. So Mina, I'm curious, like what was your childhood like? Like what kind of kid were you?
I was a very shy and quiet kid. I know that for sure. I consider myself as an adult. I consider myself an ambivert. Majority of the time I am a bit extroverted, however, but I'm definitely both. But as a kid, I was definitely an introvert. I didn't start really getting more of an extroverted side until I became a young adult and like started going to college and different things like that. But as a kid, I was just very shy. I was very quiet. A lot of that came from the fact that I was bullied as a kid. Bullying for me started when I was in first grade. So that's very, very young. And that impacted my self-esteem a lot. So I always wanted to be invisible, which is why I think it attributed to me being a very shy and quiet person. Cause I knew I always was that kid who didn't want to be seen because I was always scared that people would target me. And so my childhood, you know, I will say that being bullied took up a lot of space in my childhood. It honestly impacted me up until I was an adult. So that was pretty, I feel like that was the foundation of my life because it wasn't something that I healed from until I was in my 20s. And that's just because from being bullied, it impacted my self-esteem, it impacted my confidence. And so as you navigate and get older, you need to have healthy self-esteem and healthy sense of self and self-worth. And I didn't have that. So by not having that, it impacted a lot of the choices that I made. It impacted how I engaged with people. And like I said, I didn't really get healing for that until I was in my 20s. So I would say that that's honestly how my childhood was. And there are, of course, great moments to my childhood, thinking about family trips and thinking about going on vacation with my family and just the different activities. We were a very active household. Almost every weekend we had somewhere to go. And I really enjoyed it. And I think that's why as an adult, I kind of always like going somewhere. And so that's why when I talk about being home during a pandemic can be a little difficult. But as a kid, I was always out. Like my family always had something to do on the weekends and in summer, we would always travel. So there were really great parts to my childhood. But I will say majority of my childhood feels like a dark, heavy cloud due to me just feeling having a low self-esteem due to being bullied.
I'm so sorry. That's I was bullied a little bit in high school, and it's brutal. I mean, it's because you know at that age you're so I'm a very sensitive person, so you know, and also introverted like you were, you know, and it's at that age you're still finding yourself, right? You're still trying to like survive in a lot of ways. You're trying to make your way in the world, and to be, you know, put upon by a bully or to be, you know, ridiculed or whatever for, usually it's just for no reason at all. It's just like, you know, it's people acting out or whatever. And it breaks my heart. I'm so sorry you had to deal with that.
No, I mean, it's okay. It's very unfortunate. But yeah, like, you know, as a kid, you don't recognize that these are just other mean 5-year-olds, you know, you take it so personally, you know, to think that another child will make you feel so less than, but when it's happening frequently and it's happening by multiple people, you know, you start to internalize it because it's like, it's not just one person bullying me. It's lots of people bullying me. And it's
right.
Why are they bullying me? And why is no one else getting bullied too? So then you really start to take it personal because it's like you're being targeted,
right.
You know? So yeah, I get it. And I'm so grateful that I found the healing that I needed, even though it didn't happen until I was an adult. But yeah, I will definitely say that took up a lot of my experiences as a kid.
Were you able to talk to your family about the bullying?
Can you say that one more time?
Yeah. Were you able to talk to your family about the bullying experiences?
That's a good question. Cause I'm thinking about this. And so my family knew to some extent, and the times they knew was when the bullying got physical, because as a kid, I did, end up with experience as well where kids hit me and it resulted in us fighting. And I had to explain to my parents, like, you know, they were teasing me and picking on me at the time. So that they knew I wasn't here, like starting fights and things like that. And it's that in itself is even unfortunate that as a kid I was fighting. But honestly, on an everyday basis, the bullying that was taking place, I did not necessarily talk about. Another thing that I will say about my childhood is I come from parents who, they, I guess they're not from this country, and I'm not sure how to describe how my parents are, specifically my mother, but they were not very empathetic in regards to providing advice, comforting advice. Mm-hmm. Because I do remember an instance where I tried to tell my mom and she was just kind of like upset that I was letting it impact me and was telling me things that I need to say to the other person. But it, you know what it was? It was just one of those experiences where, you know, people have good intentions, but they're just giving you horrible advice and it's not making you feel good. You know, like it's like that friend who, you know, they love you and you know, they care, but their advice to you is just like, this isn't it. Like, this is not going to work. And that's what it was for me as a kid. Like my mom's way of helping me deal with the bullying was not helpful. And so it just resulted in me carrying it. And my dad was much older when he had me. So I never really shared much with him when it came to me being bullied as a kid. It was more so my mom I would go to, and she, like I said, she just wasn't helpful. So I feel like I carried all of that by myself.
That's a lot to hold on. It must have felt very isolating.
Very. It was very, very isolating, especially because, like I said, one of the things that I recognized at a very early age was no one else is getting bullied the way I'm getting bullied. And so I already felt isolated around my peers because they weren't getting bullied. I just didn't understand why I was being targeted. And so then to have to hold that in and not share it with people, or like my friends, when I did share it with them, I don't feel like they understood because it wasn't happening to them. So it was definitely was a very isolating experience.
When you know, into your adulthood in your 20s, you mentioned like when you started trying to heal from these traumatic experiences being bullied, do you look back on that time and like, do you question like why it happened to you? Like, why were you specifically bullied?
That's a good question. It's actually not something I ever think about. I don't recall I ever thought about that before. So that is a good question. But I mean, I know that, I guess it's also because in retrospect, when I look back, so I was teased as a child because I was like really tall. I'm 5'10", which to me now as an adult, that's not even that tall. But as a kid, I was tall since I was a child. So a lot of kids would tease me saying that I got left back. So they'll tease me for those types from like my physical traits, or at the time as well, I had a very, very large overbite. And so it wasn't until middle school that I got braces. But I guess it's because I don't think about it often, too, because when I think about the reasons that they bullied me, it's not that it's valid. They still shouldn't have done it. But I guess I'm like, oh, it's because in a way I probably was an easy target because I was different. And I do see what my differences were. My differences were I was the tallest kid in the class. My differences were facial features wise. I literally looked different from everyone else. And so I guess that's kind of like why. And that's why I grew up always feeling different, because I knew I was different. It wasn't until I got older, more so like I reached high school, that I started to really blend in. Not even high school, more so middle school. When I reached middle school, I started to blend in with other kids. Like when I reached middle school, by the time I reached sixth grade, I got braces and other kids had braces. I wasn't the only, there were girls who were taller than me. So all of the things that made me weird in elementary school seemed very normal in middle school and high school. So in retrospect, when I think about it, I think kids were just bullying me because I didn't look like them. And again, like that's not a valid excuse to bully someone. But at the same time, I was like, oh, I'm a target because I'm different. And now that I own who I am, I don't really spend too much time thinking about, I don't really think about that.
Yeah. It's weird and interesting, this thing we do as humans, because it's, you know, that kind of thing still exists in the world, right? It's like, it's othering, right? It's when we feel like we don't know what this thing is, and maybe you represented that because you look different or whatever, you didn't blend in, you didn't fit in. And then we call it out. We have to, like, I don't know, there's something in us that like makes us feel uncomfortable with it or something. And it sits very upsetting in me. It feels tremendously wrong. Cause we still do it, like, as a society, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. We still other each other. We other each other based off gender, sexual preference, identity, race, religion. Like, we are so separated in so many ways, and we target people. That targeting is still there. And, you know, it's very, very unfortunate. So it's something that I've dealt with since I was a child. And even now, I guess as an adult, I don't feel, not that I don't feel it, but it doesn't have the same impact because I have healing tools, and I'm also an adult, right? Like as a child, you do not have any of the skills or insight or level of emotional, intelligence to really know how to tackle someone othering you at 5, 6 years old. Generally, this is why having healthy parenting and adults and caregivers and teachers and things like that, because these are the people who help you self-regulate, and these are the people who help you in these stages of your development, because you're still growing. But as an adult now, I'm lucky that I have the tools that I have to help me build resilience and push against these systems of oppression that I have to navigate in my day-to-day life, because in a way it is systemic bullying. It's bullying in many different ways. And it's like, you know, I hope that we can get to a place in our society where we stop doing this to each other, because it doesn't help us progress and it doesn't help cultivate community. And so, yeah, I definitely think that this othering thing still exists, and it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I at times I have no words, because it's deeply upsetting. It's deeply upsetting that othering, you know, racism, white supremacists, you know, storming the U.S. Capitol, talk about extreme examples, but real life examples, right? And it's all kinds of fucked up.
Right. Absolutely.
So you wrote in, I was reading some of your pieces this week, Mina, and one of them was a Huffington Post article you wrote called An Open Letter to Black Women About Mental Health. And in it, you mentioned, quote, "I was 16 years old when I came to the conclusion that I could no longer handle the life that I was given, and I became suicidal." Do you want to talk a little bit about that time in your life?
Yeah.
And what that looked like for you?
Yeah. So that pretty much stemmed, like I said, I didn't get the healing that I needed until I was in my 20s. And so, as I said, you know, when you deal with certain things at a very, very young age, it can shape you in many different ways, and you don't know what direction that's going to go in. For me, it went in the direction of me having low self-esteem, low self-worth, lack of confidence, just a lack of sense of self, and just a lot of identity issues, a lot of struggles with loving myself. And that grew with me over time. So it was like I was still having the feelings of my 5-year-old self in a 16-year-old's body. Mm. And outside of those things, I was also dealing with issues at home where my father was progressively sick. My dad had diabetes, and he was diagnosed many years prior, but he did not take good care of himself. So his health was rapidly declining. And watching my dad go through surgeries, have multiple heart attacks, he had to have a pacemaker. Witnessing that at a very young age, while also having the feelings, the unhealed feelings from my childhood, and then being 16, trying to navigate the world, you're in high school. So like navigating puberty, I had already went through puberty, but like still like, who am I and what do I want? And like boys and just all these different things that a 16-year-old might go through. And I had got to a place where I was just so depressed, and I didn't recognize it as depression at the time. I just felt very miserable. I felt lonely. I felt isolated. I felt like I didn't have meaning. I didn't feel like there was much to live for. And I decided that maybe, you know, my time on life expired. Like maybe there's no point to it. I remember struggling with a while, like struggling with the meaning of life and like, you know, what is the point of it? And also going through these emotions of like human rights and do we have a right to kill ourselves? Like I was literally thinking all these things at 16. Mm. And yeah. I was just like, you know what? Like, why not do it? Why? Like, what's holding me back? Like, why not do it? I feel like I have a right to do it if I just feel like there's no point to this. If I've been miserable pretty much my whole life, and that's literally how I felt. I felt very unhappy my whole entire life. So it was very hard for me to imagine a life where I would find peace, joy, happiness, because at the time I was 16. And like I said, the bullying started at 5, and I don't remember anything before 5 years old. I'm an infant. So it's like I'm a toddler and an infant. So it literally feels like your whole entire life was just hard. And so, and like I said, there were good things happening, but for me, it always felt like the negative outweighed the good. And I was just kind of like, well, then what is the point of sticking around for more bad things to happen? And that's when I decided, you know, maybe I do want to commit suicide. And so I started cutting. I started cutting myself. And through cutting myself, clearly I did not succeed at committing suicide. But what did happen is I started to feel a sense of relief through through cutting. And it became this addictive habit. We're harming myself. It was like a drug. Like, you know, instead of me drinking, instead of me smoking, I cut. That was my addiction. And that was the thing that I realized after I did it the first few times. And the first few times was a suicide attempt, but when it wasn't happening, I started to continue to go back to it, no longer thinking about suicide, but realizing, oh, this is actually a way that I can cope. This is actually making me feel good. Maybe I should just keep doing this. And that is what happened. And the way that I was able to get out of it or heal from it. The story is very blurry because I don't remember too many parts of that difficult time in my life. So I will start off by saying that. But I do remember someone seeing the cuts on my wrist. And there was just so much shame that this is the part where I feel like shame actually drove me to healing. And I know that in a way sounds like crazy. Like how is that possible when shame is such a heavy emotion? Yeah. But I did not want no one to see my brokenness. I did not, to me, cutting was my sacred act. It was a private thing between me and myself. And that's how it helped me feel good. And once someone saw what I was doing, it brought up all these feelings of embarrassment, shame, just feeling horrible about myself. That's when literally a light bulb went off. And I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is not good. And this is, it sounds insane. It might sound crazy to some who's hearing it, but it literally was the moment that I needed where I was just like, oh my gosh, like someone saw this and this is not what I actually thought it was. It was like I created this false sense of reality and yeah. Someone woke me up from my dream. Mm. That's literally what it felt like. I created this world where cutting was okay, cutting was healthy, cutting was this, and someone seeing my cuts made me wake up. And it was like, yeah. Cutting is not healthy. And you know it's not healthy, which is why you're feeling the emotions you're feeling in response to this person seeing your wounds. Yes. And this is the wake-up call that you needed. And I was like, oh my God, I have to stop doing this. And literally, I did. And after that is when I realized I needed to see someone and I needed to talk to someone and I didn't even know what that meant. But I remember just being in school and I just had a really, really bad day to the point where I was in the hallway just crying. I wasn't in class. So the hallway was empty and one of the school staff members saw me and she and I had a good relationship and she's like, what is wrong with you? And I'm just sobbing and I'm sobbing. And she's like, you need to go talk to the guidance counselor. So she took me to the guidance counselor's office and we clicked immediately. And at the time, you know, I'm not thinking that this is therapeutic. I don't even know what therapeutic means. Right. But the guidance counselor made it a safe space for me to talk to her. And that highly helped. That helped a lot with me being able to just stop the cutting cold turkey. And I guess it's because I felt like I had someone I could talk to. It wasn't, I didn't feel like I could talk to a friend. I didn't feel like I could talk to my family. So I literally carried everything that I was dealing with my whole life. And I found this woman who just listened to me for 45 minutes. And I was like, okay, this is great. I'll see you next week. And I did it week after week after week. And that played a big role in my healing from cutting.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
I think there's so much profundity in this story, which is a couple of things. One, just like the power of being seen, right? And feeling safe enough with that guidance counselor to like be seen and to share. Like, you know, sometimes, I mean, we talked about this before, like the perspective, like sometimes others can give us when we meet people where they are, you know?
Right.
The other thing being, I so relate. And I think it's so human, just how insular we get in our things. Like you were feeling like, this is my world, this cutting, you know, and I've been there myself. We can't see outside of it. You know, it takes an external force of some kind sometimes. Like I remember I in my late teens, I was experiencing a battle with anorexia and I was studying abroad in Wales, Swansea, Wales. And a doctor told me like, your heart is going to stop unless you like, you know, unless you start eating, right? Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, you know, of course that's the case. Like in retrospect, I'm like, of course, like that's a thing I need to do. But like in my sickness, in my like isolation, I was convinced that this is the world I needed. I needed to manage my anxiety, manage my depression, you know, all by myself through, you know, starving myself. But it took, you know, it took someone outside of me to say like, hey, what's going on here? you know?
Yeah. I totally get it. You know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like the experience of seeing things objectively and having community and having support people who can show you like, hey, this is what we see going on. Like, are we like, is this real? Like, what's happening? Cause this is what we see. So like, you know, it was the same thing in this scenario where it's like, her eyes and her shock made me realize people see, like, you actually are seen. You're not the invisible person that you thought you were. And this reality that you created is being watched. People can see it also. And it's not real. And they're seeing past the facade. And that is really what helped me get to the place of recognizing that I had to make a change.
Beautiful. And you deserve to be seen. Right.
Right. Like, right.
We all deserve to be seen and loved and cared for and, you know, just meeting each other where we're at in the moment, emotionally, cognitively, all those things. Like, we all deserve that.
Absolutely. Yes. I truly, truly agree. We all deserve it. You know, and we have to believe we deserve it is what's most important.
Yeah. I'm so grateful you found that guidance counselor. It's might have what saved your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's always so crazy when I think back at the story, you know, because there's so many moving parts to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not as I try to describe it and explain it in a very linear way, but it's just so far from linear. You know, and so sometimes it's a little difficult for me to put it all into words, but I'm so, so grateful for that moment in my journey.
So you talk a little bit about, and you know, you have you started your own, I guess, I don't know what's a business. Anyways, literacy and storytelling in mental health. Like, these are two areas that you're interested in, curious about. I myself, like, am a huge book nerd. I have a degree in literature. Like, books are my jam, and books are the thing. Like, growing up, feeling very isolated myself and alone a lot in my family, books were the thing that, you know, were my savior in a lot of ways. They like allowed me to empathize with characters, and it you know, they helped me immensely. Like, when you think about literacy and storytelling and mental health and those things cross over for yourself, like, what does that mean to you?
So literacy played a huge role in my healing as well. So as a child, I loved books. I think books saved me in many, many different ways. Mm. When I think about the fact that I felt very alone, reading is what made me feel like I had something or someone. From the time I was a kid, I just loved to read. And when I reached high school is when I started to do things like journaling. I would like create vision boards. Before I even knew what a vision board was, I was creating them in my room and carving out words from magazines and hanging them up. And they were always words of like inspiration and words that I wished I could become or be. And for me, I stuck with that because it played a huge role in my healing. And it's something that helps me sustain my mental health even now, with where I am in my journey. You know, it's about prevention. It's about what are the tools that you have that can help you navigate life. And for me, reading and literature is that thing. Writing is that thing. And so, yeah, I just found that storytelling it just brings you to another universe. And not only do I read, there was a point in my life where I did not read self-help books. But now I'm very particular with the type of self-help books that I read. And I'm a big fan of also reading fiction. You know, when I give book recommendations, I include fiction in that also, because there's something powerful about a story. And I think sometimes we get so caught up on what are the how-to guides and What are the mm-hmm. things that I need? That sometimes we forget to just walk in our humanity. And I think fiction reminds us of what it is to be a full person. You know, not a person that always needs to be fixed, a person that always needs to carry this toolbox everywhere we go because we're so scared that X, Y, Z is going to happen. What is it to just live? And it's really about balancing that, right? Because every you know, we spend our whole lives healing and growing. That's never going to stop until the day that we die. That's a part of the journey. But I think at some point we also have to take into account that living is a part of the journey. The journey is not just how can I fix. It's also about how can I live. And so I think literature and storytelling helps us to do both. And so that's why it's just really, it's something, like I said, that played a huge role in my ability to heal as a kid or sustain myself in many, many ways. And I still utilize it now.
Yeah, same. I wonder, what were some of those books that you were drawn to as a child?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I was a huge Harry Potter fan growing up. Sure. I was so big on Harry Potter. I probably, at some point as I got older, the story started to feel a little disconnected from me. So I did not read every book in the series. And that actually went on for a long time anyway, outside of me being a kid. But Harry Potter is like a literal childhood memory. What else did I read as a kid? I honestly feel like Harry Potter took up, because those books were so thick. I read other things, but that, if I'm thinking about books I read as a child, Harry Potter always stands out. Like, that's always the number one thing that stands out. But moving more toward adulthood, Britt Bennett is one of my favorite authors. She only has two books, but both books are so, so powerful. After she wrote her first book, I literally sat around waiting for the day that there was an announcement that she signed a second book deal, because I'm like, we need more books in the world by her. So as an adult, Britt Bennett is amazing. Some other authors that I love to read are The Four Agreements is a book that I really, really love. And that book is written by Don Miguel Ruiz. And that's another book that I truly love. Books by Rebecca Solnit. That's another author that I truly love. So I would say that growing up, just in a world of literature and reading, are things that have helped me heal and things that I utilize in my practices to just continue to manage my mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. I relate to the, I must be older than you, because Harry Potter came out later, but, I totally relate to the, like, reading. Like, I read a lot of, you know, Jack London books, you know, sort of adventure stories of, like, boys in the woods with their dogs, you know, and then definitely a lot of, like, fantasy too, because I was like, I need to escape the reality of life and just jump into these fantasy worlds with dragons and magic and all that stuff. So I relate to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely why I think Harry Potter was just so big. And that's probably why it's all I remember as a kid, because Harry Potter was just like my escape.
Do you have a like a reading, standard reading practice now, that you try to like read a certain number of books a year, or you're pretty flexible about it?
I so in 2020, prior to that, I did. I was like, you know, and the number was never like humongous. Well, you know, that's all subjective. But for me, it was always like, try to read at least a book a month. 2020 came, however, and I will say my reading slowed down, and I found myself pressuring myself to pick it back up. But I said, I'm gonna just let it be. Life is happening and it's overwhelming. And right now, maybe this just is something that I need to take a break from. Yeah. So now that it's 2021, I do have a lot of books on my to read list that I'm like, okay, I really wanna pick this back up and tackle it. But I told myself I'm not going to set a number for the year, because I also found that setting a number kind of brought up these emotions of like, if you don't fulfill it, like, you know, what does that even mean? It just means that you didn't read all those books that you said you were going to read. It doesn't mean anything more than that. But I told myself, like, right now, I just want to savor the moment. And so I am picking back up on my reading, but I'm not going to set like a specific goal in mind of how many I want to read.
Yeah. No, I think that's smart. I mean, I did for this year because, you know, I'm someone who gets a lot out of reading. And, you know, to your point very earlier about being intentional about our time, like when I'm creating space to read, I'm more grounded. I'm feeling better emotionally. And so this year, before 2021 started, I created a list of 30 books. I mean, probably a little higher than I usually read, but some books that I've been wanting to read for a long time, some classics, some, you know, indigenous and black history and books on that stuff. And, you know, just some stuff that, like, I know I've been wanting to read, need to read. And it's going well so far. I'm feeling like very motivated, and maybe it's just because we're still in January. I don't know.
Yeah, I totally get it. You know, so that's why I'm like, I'll see what happens. I have so much stuff that I need to tackle. So, you know, I'll get to it at whatever pace that I get to it.
Yeah. Wonderful. Let's start to wrap up here. Mina, we always wrap up the show talking about empathy heroes. So people, real life people we know, friends, family members, whatever, or they could be characters from stories even, or Queen's Gambit, who knows? just people in our lives or characters that are very empathetic. I'm going to go first to name my empathy heroes this week to give you a moment to think about yours.
Okay.
My empathy heroes this week are, so the aforementioned 2021 reading list, in conjunction with that, I created, so we live in this area where, we're like south of LA, but we're like in kind of a rural pocket, and our neighbors who we've been sort of bubbling with in this pandemic have this huge backyard, and there's beautiful trees everywhere. And so every Sunday, and yesterday was the second one, every Sunday we have what we're calling Framley Reading Hour, which is like friends and family. So just like a few of us, and we're all separated, you know, just spread out in the backyard. And there's tea and coffee and some treats. And we just read for an hour to an hour and a half to 2 hours, just silently read our books. And that's the number one rule. Just show up, have space, intentional space to read. And it's been wonderful. And so my empathy heroes are like Becky and Norm and Jen and Dennis and Hazel and Nico, the kids, and Char and Sammers, also kids, and my partner Jessica, and us just hanging out, and Gwen and Luke, just hanging out in the backyard reading. It's been a joy, and I'm looking forward to every Sunday in, you know, the future. So those are my empathy heroes.
That sounds so beautiful.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, I guess for me, as you talk, I'm going to name two people. Yeah. My first one is my best friend, who I've known pretty much my whole life. We met when we were 5 years old. So this is the longest relationship that I ever had. And I would definitely describe her as my empathy hero. She's someone who listens to understand. That's important. And models, you know, just what it means to be compassionate and, you know, just very caring. And I, like I said, because we've known, the reason why we still are able to be good friends is because empathy and understanding is there. You know, this is a very, very long friendship. So that's definitely my first empathy hero. My second one is going to be very non-traditional, but I'm going to say this person or this this being, because I feel like they teach me a great level of empathy. And I think it's also great to have people or beings in your life that do that. And that's my dog. And he is just the sweetest thing. I never had a dog. So when I got him, I struggled so much. I'm doing this all by myself. So it's not like I have support. And I didn't realize how difficult it would be taking care of a puppy. Well, so, you know, for me, at least it felt difficult. And I heard stories of how difficult it is. But getting him, I'm like, wow, this really is difficult. However, through that period of difficulty, I was able to learn so much about myself. And I feel like that played such a huge role in my development. And that sounds, like I said, might sound so strange to hear that a dog could do so much, but
it doesn't. Dogs are the best.
That I'm seeing. Now I'm getting it. Now I see why people are devout dog owners, because I'm just like, this is so amazing. And he teaches me such kindness and warmth. And I think a lot of it just falls into the fact that you literally have to take care of something that's not yourself. And that was one of the biggest struggles for me when I brought him home, having to give like I said, I'm alone. And so when you live alone and it's just you and you only have to think about you, you know, when it's you in your private time, it can be really hard to share that with, I have to feed you, I have to potty train you, I have to train you in general, I have to do all these things. This is hard. I only have to do this for myself and I don't even require this much. Well, I probably do require more maintenance, but I'm going to name him as my little doggy, as my empathy hero, just because he has taught me so much about myself. And by learning about myself, I can continue to be empathetic toward others.
Amazing. I mean, I've named one of my dogs, Scooby, as my empathy hero probably numerous times on this show. So dogs are just naturally empathy heroes. So there you go.
Yes, I agree.
And Bentley is your dog's name, right?
Yes, Bentley.
Bentley, the empathy hero. I love it. Well, Mina, where can the listeners out there connect with you?
They can connect with me on Instagram. My handle is MINAA_B. And they can also connect with me on my website if they wanted to contact me at www.minaab.com. And either through my website or through my Instagram, you can find a link to join my newsletter where you can connect with me biweekly, which is when I send out different content.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being a part of this. I really appreciate you getting a little vulnerable and sharing your story. And I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you, Noam. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And to you listeners, as I always say, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring, pale blue dot. We have each other. It's you, me, empathy.